Welcome to Calling All Pets from Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Larry Mueller here with Public Radio's favorite zoologist, Patricia McConnell. And if you're curious about your pet's behavior, give us a call. Here's the number, 1-800-462-7413. That's 1-800-462-7413. In addition to the calls this hour, we have another special topic to share. And what is it this time, Patricia?
Well, here's a question for you, Larry. How would you feel about renting out your pet for the weekend to somebody you didn't know? Would you do it?
No. No way.
Well, you know, there are businesses popping up that specialize in renting pets. So we're going to talk about that a little bit later, why I think it's a bad idea.
Mostly. Especially for the animals.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, we'll talk about that. And we'll talk about amphibians. Amphibians have been around since the age of dinosaurs. And today, many of them are facing their own extinction. So today, we'll talk about what's happening to amphibians and why it matters to us. Plus, a little later, we'll also hear again from cowboy poet Baxter Black. That's all ahead. First, the number for you to call, 1-800-462-7413. And here's our first caller. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
This is Amanda from Tacoma Park, Maryland.
Well, Amanda, it is a great pleasure to speak with you. And what can we do for you?
Well, I'm having problems teaching tricks to my dog. He can do the basic, easy things. He can sit and stand up. But I did successfully teach him to roll over, but now he's kind of generalizing roll over into a bunch of other just silly little acts.
What does he do?
Spins around in circles. He kind of starts to make like a half somersault. He'll like just roll around on his back.
You know, I'm laughing. It's just a great image, isn't it? I mean, it might be a little frustrating when you're trying to train it.
It's cute, obvious to me that he doesn't understand what I'm getting at.
Trainers call that offering up behaviors. And there's actually trainers, especially in the marine animal world, but I've heard of it. I think Ken Ramirez at the Shedd Aquarium has done this with dogs. Actually train an animal. There's a cue that means you make up something that you've never done before.
Mm-hmm.
So I just don't, so maybe your dog, that's sort of advanced, you know, that's the PhD of dog training. But here's what I do now is when what he's doing is he's desperately trying to get you to give him a reinforcement. Is it this? Is it that? Is it this? Is it that?
Yeah, yeah.
And your job is just to teach him by being very patient, but also very quick when you reinforce him appropriately.
Mm-hmm.
What you want and what you don't want. So when he, say you ask him to roll over,
mm-hmm.
might he spin then?
Yes.
Okay. There are a couple of things that could be going on. One is he doesn't want to roll over. And one thing about rolling over, Larry, that I think is not obvious is that it actually is something a lot of dogs don't like to do. And I think being anthropomorphic here in this case is sometimes helpful. Do you want to lie down on the ground,
mm-hmm.
you know, and roll over? Not always. Not everywhere. So, and I know dogs, it actually hurts them to roll over.
Okay.
So what you might want to do, just drop the roll over for a little bit and work on some other tricks. I'm teaching Willie, my favorite new trick. It's called, Are You Ashamed of Yourself?
Okay.
And he runs and he puts his head under a little pad on the ground and buries his head under like a blanket or a pillow or something.
That sounds like something my dog would like to do.
Unbelievably cute. There's a great book out there. It's called 101 Dog Tricks. It's an excellent book. I highly recommend it.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so I would work on other tricks. Teach, use things he's doing, you know, and work on spin and work on, you know, look pretty and work on, you know, take a Kleenex out of my pocket when I sneeze. But the trick is when he does the wrong thing, just turn away from him and just wait a second and then ask him to do something that's easy for him, like sit, and then reward him instantly. Part of this, what's going on might be because you're not reinforcing him fast enough when he does do what you want.
I see.
Good luck, Amanda.
So those are some ideas. So try that and send us a videotape.
I will. Well, thank you so much.
Okay.
Thanks, Amanda. Thanks very much for calling. And I tell you what, Patricia, we get all kinds of emails. And did you know that? I bet you did know
that. I'm shocked.
Well, here's one you haven't seen yet.
Well, good.
James in Racine sent us an email asking for your advice about how to properly train his new kitten. And here's what he writes. I've been asking for a kitten for many years, but my wife didn't want one around because of the potential for scratched furniture or the need to clean up after it. and the occasional smell of the litter box. So those are the negatives. This year on my birthday, however, she presented me with a pretty little tiger kitten, and we both have fallen in love with her.
Ooh.
We've used a clicker just before we feed her, and she responds to it instantly, no matter where she is in the house. Now I'd like to train her to come, wherever I am, to the command, come, or Annie, come, using the clicker to initiate the response to the command. Annie likes small commercial treats and seems to be very smart. She's a good one. How do I do this training properly so that I don't get her all confused and fail in my attempt to train her?
Oh, it's a great question. And you're going to have this done in the next 3 days.
Well, good.
Because if you've already trained her to come to a clicker, when you say come to the clicker, I'm assuming what you mean is that you click and then she comes running. So basically, you've trained her to come to a sound, and all you need to do is train her to come to a different sound. So she's got the concept. So it's relatively easy to just switch what is the cue, just switch the sound. So I would just say, is it Annie? Was that the little kid's name? I would say, Annie, come. Or you could say, Annie, because that's a vocalization that cats
You
give.
Can say that.
Larry, do it. Larry can do
I
it. Come
can't
on. You
it.
Can try
no,
it.
No, I can't.
Oh, come
I
on.
Have to just my mouth, my lips.
Well, that worked, actually. It's sort of cute watching him get all fish-lipped-y when he does that. So you can do your lips or you can go, you can use any noise you want, but make sure it's a noise you don't use otherwise. And then click. And just do that over and over and over again. So it's Annie, come, click. And then you reinforce her as soon as she comes. And then after just even a couple of days, just say, Annie, come. And when she does, oh, you're going to jackpot. Treat, 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 like 10 little cat treats in a row. Like, that was the smartest thing you've ever done in the entire world. So you can do this in like 2 days. It's a deal.
It's great.
Oh, yeah. Cats are really, they're very easy to train. They really are.
Patricia has been known to solve many problems in 1 or 2 days. Sometimes it takes a little longer.
Just on occasion, yeah.
But if you have an email question, a question you'd like to email us, how do they do that,
we
Patricia?
We'd love to hear from you. We'll train you to email us. We'll give you lots of reinforcement.
Click, click, click.
Just go to pets@wpr.org.
And call us at 1-800-462-7413 if you have a question, too. We can take your call, just like our next caller. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hello.
Who are we speaking with?
Oh, I'm Gloria from Duluth, Minnesota.
Thanks for calling, Gloria. What's on your mind?
Well, I have 3 wonderful cats named Jenny, Spooky, and General Rommel. and I'm going on a trip to New York to my son's wedding this coming weekend, and I'll be gone for about 10 days. I have a friend coming in to feed them and occasionally, you know, stop in and play with them. But my question was, I'm just wondering if I should leave more than a few lights on or music playing low, or am I just, you know, I'm just wondering, does this matter to cats, or am I just imposing my own neurotic fears on them of a dark, lonely house, you know? I mean, do they care if it's dark and quiet?
I don't know. I really don't. You know, so here's my guess, is that some cats do and some cats don't. I think what's most important is matching the personality of your cat. Some cats are so affiliative to people. And I'm not going to pretend that they don't miss having people there. I mean, ideally, if the cats aren't at a boarding facility, then you have somebody live in your house. There's no question about it that that's ideal. You can't always pull that off, though. So I sympathize with the difficulties of that. What I would suggest is that when the people who come to check in on them, that they do more than just coming in, scooping out the litter box, making sure there's food there, changing the water, is that they come in, they spend, you know, ask them to bring a book and a magazine and hang out for an hour, turn on the lights, interact with the cats, play with the cats, make it feel more like it's homey and they're not sort of a dark, quiet house. Because I think those factors can indeed be something that cats become conditioned to, maybe not consciously, but just like we become conditioned to certain changes in the environment that we associate with feeling sort of comforted and at home. There's no reason that cats couldn't have that same kind of conditioning. So have your friend come and do more than just hang out, and then I think they'll be fine. And congratulations on your son. Just go have a great time.
Well, thank you very much. And I do have my friend who's coming as a cat person, and very nice person named Susan, so she'll be happy to play with them in a draft.
Good.
Have fun, Gloria.
All right. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. 1-800-462-7413, the number to call for you to join in. Coming up next, we'll discuss the new business of renting pets. We'll hear Patricia's take on that topic right after this. I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell. You're listening to Calling All Pets from Wisconsin Public Radio.
The Calling All Pets website offers a variety of information, including online archives of the show, pet tips, Patricia's dog training books, and the opportunity to submit email questions. The website is callingallpets.org. Pet books and training guides are available through the radio store at 800-747-7444.
Welcome back to Calling All Pets. I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell. And Tricia, you mentioned that there are some new businesses popping up that specialize in renting cats and dogs out to people who just want to borrow them for a few days. I'm going to make a wild guess and speculate that you're not so sure this is a good idea.
Whatever made you think that, Larry? Well, you're right. And I have to say, I am full of sympathy for people who could use some warm cuddles, you know, for a dog or a cat on a weekend. But I am really saddened by the concept of renting out a companion animal like it was a videotape. You know, renting an animal for a weekend may be good for the human. You know, like I can see that it would be. But dogs are highly social animals. They're designed to be part of stable social groups. Cats are strongly attached to locations. And they're notoriously slow for being able to adapt to new places. So, you know, even if the people who are doing the renting, they're kind, they have the best of intentions, think how confusing it would be for an animal to try to figure out a new set of rules every week or every day. Dogs and cats need clarity. They need consistency. And we humans, I mean, we're bad enough as it is, Larry.
We're confusing enough as it is.
Right.
Well, it makes me wonder, how are the people doing the renting checked out? Are the companies sure the people can be trusted, for example?
Yeah, it's a really good question. From what I understand, there's a questionnaire, there's an interview that goes on. But, you know, I got to say, I like to think I'm a pretty good judge of character. Larry, I suspect you are too. But, you know, I sure as heck wouldn't send one of my animals home with somebody after chatting with them for a half an hour. But I have to say, I'm not so much worried about the renters as I am about the animals themselves.
You know, you mentioned to me off air that these businesses get their animals from shelters and rescue groups.
Well,
Is that right?
That's what they say. And if it's true, then the animals especially need consistency, even more than before. You know, you can't take animals who've been displaced and possibly traumatized, which often happens even in the best of shelters, and then pass them around like DVDs and expect them to do well in that kind of situation. But I have to say, Larry, I don't know of a shelter or a rescue group who is credible who would ever place an animal into a situation like that, into which they're going to be rented out by the hour.
So we're not going to be seeing ads for Patricia's Dog Rental Emporium?
Sure. Oh, yeah, sure. Yeah, you can rent Lassie for a weekend. You just need $5 million and your firstborn child. And I have to come along, too, as a chaperone, and I will never let her out of my sight. But otherwise, no problem.
So when it comes to renting, let's stick with the DVDs?
Yeah, good idea.
Well, we want to know what you think about the idea of renting a pet. So please send us comments through our website at callingallpets.org. And Patricia, thanks for informing us and letting us know about this. I did not know.
Would love to hear what people think.
And here's the number for you to call with a question about anything relating to animals. 1-800-462-7413. And we have another caller online. So let's go there. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
My name's Carol. I'm from Destin, Florida.
Carol, pleased to meet you. Thanks for calling, and what can we do for you?
Well, I have an 8-year-old pound puppy named Phil, and about 6 months ago, I came home from work and found that he had gotten behind my TV and ripped all the wires out.
Oh, no. Uh-oh.
And we were fine for a couple days. Then I came home, he had gotten in the closet and shredded boxes,
oh,
a wicker
dear.
Basket,
so he's being
a plastic
destructive.
Basket. After about four or five times, I figured out this was happening at the same time that the Air Force base behind us was doing training bombing.
This is an amazingly common problem, believe it or not. I've had so many dogs who were diagnosed actually with separation anxiety who were flipping out because the National Guard was going over every other day at 3:30.
We've lived here 3 years before it started happening.
And that's such a confusing thing about those kind of fears. Think of phobias like you think about allergies. They actually develop over time, and they get worse and worse and worse rather than better and better and better. You know, fears can go two ways. You can habituate to a fear, and with repeated exposure to it, you stop worrying about it because nothing happens. But with a phobia, it's the opposite. It's like an allergy. The more you're exposed, the worse you get. So how often does this happen, and how predictable is it?
Well, they do the bombing very sporadically, but every time they bomb, he does it if he's home alone. If somebody's here with him, he's fine.
Right, right. There are a couple things you can do. None of them are simple. I have to warn you, vaccinate you. For animals who are sound phobic, one of the things I've had some success with is building the dog a safe house, creating a place for them to run into that's maybe sound insulated. But the idea is a denny place that damps the sound down, that feels safe and secure, maybe even has a double entry system. And you train him to go in there, and you give him chicken in there. And so you basically are training the dog
to go in there
when this happens, I go in this place and I'm safe and it's not as loud and it's safe and I'm secure and I'm okay.
Right.
That's been very successful. And I think that's the first thing I'd try if I were you.
Okay.
There are lots of other things to try for sound phobias, but that's the first one I'd try.
Okay, great.
You're sure he's not trying to hook up the VCR?
Watch Animal Planet.
Watch Animal Planet. Thanks a lot for calling. 1-800-462-7413, our number. Patricia, a listener named Lisa in Washington, D.C., emailed us to tell us about her 10-year-old border collie named Max. Max has been a trash collector all his life. On walks, he goes after and eats white stuff, paper, tissues, paper towels. Unfortunately, despite his prowess, there's still trash on the streets. Once he ate a plastic container with mayonnaise in it, and afterwards he threw up the plastic.
Good.
Lisa is often able to see the trash before Max does, and she's able to steer him away from it. However, once he gets something white, it's difficult or impossible to get it out of his mouth. And Lisa wants to know, why is he going for the white stuff?
Well, it's because it's the right stuff. The white stuff is the right stuff. You know, white stuff is often petroleum-based, oil-based paper products, tissue, toilet paper, paper towels, and dogs love it. And, you know, I asked for years at seminars because I never understood, why do dogs love Kleenex? Why do dogs love paper towels? Because they do. And finally, a chemist at one of my seminars who was in the audience raised her hand and said, they're petroleum-based products, and they have oil in them, and dogs perceive them as food. It was like, that's the best answer I've ever heard. So I'm going with that one. I don't know that this is true, but, you know, it's the first logical answer I ever got. So white stuff, generally, if you think about it, it's usually tissue, Kleenex, or it's a food wrapper that had food in it. So basically your dog has just learned, if it's white, it's right. Because it tastes like food. So here's what I would do if it was my dog. One, I would teach a great leave it. And I can't describe exactly how to do that quickly on the radio, but one of my books, which you can get at the website, callingallpets.org, Family Friendly Dog Training, talks about how to teach take it, which is the flip side. So it's sort of like a game, because drop it is always the flip side of take it. So take it, drop good dog, take it, drop good dog, and then you can start using drop when there was no take it, you know, when they took it on their own volition. So I would teach take it, drop, and work your way up slowly to using it when you really need it. And I would also teach a leave it. Leave it, which means that's when you see it and you say, leave it. I just did that with Willie not too long ago, my young border collie. He was about to eat something we don't even want to really think about. But dogs love to eat. And I said, leave it. And bless his little heart, his little head whipped around. And I ran a little bit away to get him to come to me and be happy to run and chase me. And then I gave him, I didn't have a treat, so I threw a stick or something. So that's what I do with your little white loving dog.
Wonderful advice. And if someone else wants some of that wonderful advice, how do they get it?
Well, we'd love it if you went to the website, for example. You could go to callingallpets.org. You could send us an email, pets@wpr.org.
And if you want an immediate response, almost, give us a call at 1-800-462-7413. And we have another caller online. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hi, how are you?
Great. Who are we speaking with?
This is Beth from Virginia.
Thanks.
Northern Virginia.
Thanks for calling, Beth. Appreciate it. And what's on your mind?
Well, I have an adorable Portuguese water dog who's 6 years old. And as he's gotten older, either he's become more entitled or I may be getting to be a worse sleeper. But instead of, you know, being curled up in a little ball at the end of the bed, he's now stretching out to basically full human size, essentially crowding me out of the bed where my husband and I have been sharing for 20 years. And I've gotten to the point where I've essentially just gone into another room and gone to sleep.
Oh, no.
And it's beginning to affect our marriage. It's been going on for about a year. And I find myself, when I do try to stay in the bed, I wake up in that little ball that he's supposed to be in, and I'm all cramped. And we've tried all kinds of things. We've tried doggy beds, really big ones. We've tried little nests on the floor with lots of blankets and pillows. But, you know, we put him down there, and then he jumps on the bed. And we tried rewarding him for staying on the floor in the little bedding, but he just jumps on the bed. And we're just either exhausted or just losing contact with each other.
You know, I call them expando pets. There's something about you put a dog or a cat in bed with you, and they expand. they get bigger and bigger, and I am so sympathetic. I had, when I was much younger, I had a St. Bernard, and we thought it'd be funny to teach him to jump up on the bed when he was a little puppy.
Uh-oh.
It was a little Mack truck, and he was incredibly incompetent at everything. And we thought, wouldn't it be cute to teach him to jump up on the bed? He literally pushed me out of bed once when I was sound asleep, and I woke up hitting the ground. Have you ever done that, Larry?
Wake up
hitting the ground. It's a bad way to wake up. And I woke up and said something like Cosby, which was a dog's name. And my husband, my ex-husband, I should mention, said, what did you do to the dog? So I'm very sympathetic. And here's my advice. It's really simple. It's not easy, but it's really simple. You're going to get that great doggy bed or a crate. You're going to put it beside your bed, and you're either going to put the dog in the crate or you're going to leash the dog to an area where he can't jump up on the bed. You're going to put him in there with a great big hollow toy stuffed with the best frozen food you could possibly cram in there. And you're going to ignore the fact that he's going to whine for 3 nights, because you're going to be laying there going like, but I'm going to have another 10 years of being able to sleep with my husband. I'm going to have another 10 years to sleep with my husband. And you're going to live through it. And after the fourth night, believe it or not, 90% of the dogs I've worked with are going to be like fine with it.
No kidding.
Yeah. Now, that's 90%, so yours might not be the one. It might be 2 weeks, it might be 3 weeks, but absolutely, I'm all for letting pets sleep in bed with you if it works out. But if it doesn't work out, your sleep in your marriage is more important.
Excellent.
And you know, Beth, you could benefit perhaps from a pet tip that we've gotten. It was sent to us by a listener named Carolyn, who found the perfect place for her dog to sleep.
Oh, good.
Here's what she writes. I acquired a toddler bed about 3 years ago for a visiting grandson. After many months, I decided it was time to give the bed to Goodwill. But at about that time, my dog Remy discovered it. The toddler bed is now his favorite spot for nighttime sleeping. Some toddler beds cost just $35, and what's more, they're the perfect place for a dog to sleep. They're up off the floor. They have sheets you can wash. And they fit my large lab just to his liking.
A lab? I was imagining she had a small dog. So our friend Beth has a Portuguese water dog, a Porty, and, you know, those are pretty big, medium-sized dogs. So, but, you know, if you don't have a toddler bed, then maybe go out and buy a dog bed.
A dog bed.
But I love this recycle idea. I think that's very creative. I love that you sent that in, Beth. Thank you. No, Beth didn't. Who was it, Carolyn?
It was Carolyn.
Carolyn, thanks. That's a great idea.
It was a great idea, and if someone else has some great ideas, how do they get to us?
Oh, send us an email. We'd love to hear from you. Just send it to pets@wpr.org.
And if you'd like to join in, the number to call 1-800-462-7413. Coming up next, hear about a crisis facing many of the world's amphibians. We'll find out why they're going extinct and what we can do about it. I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell, and you're listening to Calling All Pets from Wisconsin Public Radio.
The Calling All Pets website offers you the opportunity to submit email questions, browse pet tips, and find out when Patricia will be in a city near you. Information online at callingallpets.org. That's callingallpets.org. Pet books and training guides are also available through the radio store at 800-747-7444.
Welcome back to Calling All Pets. I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell, and today we welcome Kevin Zippel to the program. Kevin is an amphibian ecologist and conservationist, and he's the program director for an amphibian conservation group known as Amphibian Arc. Kevin, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Larry.
You say that we're facing the first mass extinction event in the Earth's history, the first since the dinosaur age. When was this crisis first discovered, and how?
Well, I'm not sure it's the biggest since the dinosaurs. There was another one in the Pleistocene that took out a lot of our large mammals, but it's certainly one of the most focused since the dinosaurs. At that time, that extinction event took out a couple other things, but really seemed to focus on one taxonomic group, the dinosaurs. And that's what we're seeing today. It's something that scientists have been suspicious of for decades. They've recognized that amphibian populations are declining, but it wasn't until 2004 when a publication was released called the Global Amphibian Assessment. And it was exactly what it sounds like. Scientists around the world went through and evaluated every known species of amphibian, which was about 6,000 at the time, and what they found basically confirmed all of our fears and then some. Almost half of all amphibian species are currently in decline. A third of all amphibian species are threatened with extinction. And another almost quarter are so exceedingly rare, we know so little about them that we just call them data deficient. But probably many of those are also extremely threatened. And in reality, somewhere between a third and a half of all amphibians are probably on the verge of extinction today, with, we think, 165 at least having gone extinct just in the past few decades.
Tell us something about some of the hypotheses about why this is happening. I know atrazine has been mentioned. I know there's a disease, apparently, that's very serious. Tell us a little bit about why you think this is going on.
Well, first and foremost, habitat destruction affects more species of amphibian than any other threat, by at least a factor of three. So, you know, all around the world, as humans are expanding our populations and consuming more resources, converting natural habitat into land that's productive for our uses, we're destroying amphibian habitat, the places where they live and breed, and in the process, we're destroying those populations.
So we're losing our wetlands?
Wetlands, any natural area where amphibians occur in the United States, it's primarily wetlands. We've drained them, filled them in, but particularly in the tropics, rainforest is where many species of amphibian are found. And again, with habitat destruction, it is the number one cause of amphibian declines, and it's also one that can be remedied in the wild. That's something that we have the means to correct, if not the will.
You know, about this time of the year, there's nothing I like more than to hear those spring peepers. And I really love the sound of frogs at any time of the day, but especially in the morning and the evening. But someone might say, why does it matter to us that things like newts and frogs are dying off?
Well, that's an excellent question. It's one that I get quite a bit, and it's fair. You know, people tend to only care about those things that have some sense of value for them. And with amphibians, I think there are lots of reasons, and I can explain a few here, and hopefully everybody can find something that they identify with. Amphibians play a vital role in the ecosystems where they're found, if you were to go into a local hardwood forest and collect all of the individual salamanders from just one species, the collective weight would be greater than that of all species of mammals combined from that same ecosystem. So a huge contribution to the biomass, and that serves two functions. That's number one, that's prey for all the predators out there in the ecosystem, and we certainly see in areas of the world where amphibians are declining or disappearing altogether, we also see a decline in those predators that have come to specialize in them. But also those amphibians are serving as predators themselves, controlling invertebrate populations that, again, in areas of the world where the amphibians are disappearing, we're seeing unchecked population growth in these pests of human crops and those insect pests that carry human disease. So amphibians are important because of that role that they play in those ecosystems.
And I know your group and other groups have called amphibians, the canary in the mine, as a possible indicator of some potential trouble. Is that correct?
That's absolutely right, Patricia. That's usually my second reason for why amphibians are important, is because they do serve as sentinels of environmental health. We have these wonderful animals who, over millions of years, have evolved very thin skin. And, you know, that's not a weakness or something that's primitive. That allows them to do things that we simply can't do, and that's to drink and to breathe directly across our skin. It does make them susceptible to any other chemicals that are out there in the environment. For example, you mentioned atrazine. It's been shown by Tyrone Hayes at the University of California at Berkeley that very low levels of atrazine can chemically sterilize developing tadpoles. Basically, it turns them into hermaphrodites, where part of their gonads is functional as male, part is female, and the entire animal is reproductively sterile.
Hmm.
And these are very low levels of atrazine, comparable to what's found in the wild, lower than what the EPA says is safe in U.S. drinking water, lower than that is found in the drinking water of millions of American homes, and yet here it is chemically sterilizing these poor amphibians. Yes, they are more sensitive, but at some concentration, certainly that has to affect people if it isn't already, when you look at all the problems that we have with reproduction and sperm count in particular.
And you do say that amphibians are contributors to human health. How is that so?
Absolutely. All amphibians have poison glands. It's one of the defining characteristics of the group. But they vary in the toxicity and the structure of the poisons that are produced. Everybody's familiar with this, at least conceptually. You know, you can eat a bullfrog, you certainly wouldn't eat a toad. Anybody who's seen a cat or a dog come into contact with a toad and try and eat it, usually they get sick and in some places will go into convulsions, if not die. And all of those poisons have different chemical structures, and some of them in dilute forms can also be active as medicines. For example, there's a small poison frog from South America that has given us a protein called epibetadine that is 200 times more potent than morphine as a painkiller, but without any of the addictive side effects. I think last month there was a number of news splashes about another frog from South America called the paradox frog that has a protein that looks like it's going to be useful in treating type 2 diabetes. And one of my favorites is a tree frog from Australia. It produces a protein in its skin that is effective in blocking HIV transmission across mucous membranes.
Wow.
Whoa.
Not exactly a cure for AIDS, but certainly a step in the right direction. And it's something that can also be applied retroactively up to, I think, 18 hours after exposure to HIV. You can put this onto the mucous membranes, and it will block HIV
wow.
getting into and infecting the tissue. So a really fantastic contribution from amphibians to human medicine. And the ironic thing is that every time we allow a species to go extinct, we're giving up one of these potential medicines. We know of at least 165 that have already disappeared in the past few decades. What cures went with them? We have no idea. We let them go before we even studied them.
Kevin, I would love to hear you talk about how you work in this field that must be sometimes really discouraging. You know, what is it that keeps you going?
Well, it is discouraging. It's a huge challenge. I think we, in the end, are probably not going to do as much as we hope we can do, but that's probably the case with most of these endeavors. But I tell myself if we are successful in preventing the extinction of just one species, it will be worth it. And I'm sure we've done at least that already, and I think there's still a lot more that we can do. But I think it's the idea of losing this spectacular biodiversity that we enjoy today and not having that available for future generations. Like, you know, I can't imagine growing up and not having the opportunity to play with amphibians in the backyard. It is a fairly depressing topic, but it's one that we have an opportunity to make a real contribution to and make a change for the future.
And we haven't talked much about Amphibian Ark, but I have to say I really enjoy your website. It's a, full of great information and fun, too, as a matter of fact. Talk a little bit more about Amphibian Ark.
We created this organization called the Amphibian Ark as sort of a global alliance to bring together all of those stakeholders who work on conservation of amphibians in captivity, primarily zoos, but also aquariums, botanical gardens, natural history museums, even universities, governments, the private sector. Get all these folks organized so that we are doing as much as we possibly can to save amphibians, because we figure there are about 500 species that really cannot be saved in the wild. No matter how many parks we set up and park guards we put out there and enforce rules and regulations, these species are facing threats like climate change and disease that we cannot at this time fix in the wild. So 500 species need to be brought onto the ARC, and our goal is to try and increase the capacity in captivity to manage those species. Currently, we think we have the resources to do about 10% of that, so we're trying to launch this campaign, the Amphibian ARC Year of the Frog, to make sure everybody understands what amphibians are, why amphibians are important, that they are in such terrible danger today, and what's being done about it.
So people should contact their local zoo and encourage them to participate.
Absolutely. Please visit www.amphibianark.org and look at the activities that we have there. Support your local zoo when they're participating in the Amphibian Ark and the Year of the Frog campaign. And our goal is to try and raise in the vicinity of $50 million, which sounds like a lot of money, but really in the big picture is not that much, especially when you break it down per species. It's only $100,000 per species. That's something that corporations can easily do, foundations, some of our philanthropic supporters out there, even individuals can pool their resources. We've got people out there doing such grassroots activities as bake sales and can drives. And whether you raise $100,000 and save a species from extinction, or whether you raise $10 and send that to a rescue facility in Panama to pay the salary of the kid who goes out and collects the grasshoppers to feed the endangered frogs in captivity, every little bit helps.
Well, Kevin, I want to thank you so much for being with us today. It was a real pleasure. Thank you for being with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks for the opportunity to share this information with your listeners.
Thanks for your work, Kevin.
Yep.
Keep it up.
Kevin Zippel is the program director of the Amphibian Conservation Initiative known as Amphibian Ark, and he joined us today from his home in Auburn, New York. Stay tuned. Our animal trivia question of the week is next, along with a special poem from cowboy poet Baxter Black. I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell, and this is Calling All Pets from Wisconsin Public Radio.
If you missed an episode of Calling All Pets, the show is available online. Our website offers archives of the show, along with the opportunity to submit email questions, browse pet tips, and learn more about a guest you heard on the program. More information available online at callingallpets.org. That's callingallpets.org.
You're listening to Calling All Pets. I'm Larry Mueller, along with Public Radio's favorite zoologist, Patricia McConnell. And it's time now for our animal trivia question of the week. And if you think you know the answer to this week's question, call our 800 number or send an email to pets@wpr.org. All correct guessers will have their names pooled together, and one lucky winner will be selected at random to win an autographed copy of For the Love of a Dog by our own Patricia McConnell. And here's today's question. In 1979, the last southern gastric brooding frog was seen in the wild. As its name indicates, the female gastric brooding frog would swallow its fertilized eggs and allow the tadpoles and froglets to develop in her stomach. Eventually, the frog's stomach would become so bloated that her lungs would collapse under the pressure, and that forced her to have to breathe through which organ?
Well, no wonder it's the last one, man. That is not an easy way to reproduce.
No, it's not. But I tell you what, if you know the answer, call our 800 number or send an email to pets@wpr.org. And to find out if you're correct, visit callingallpets.org, and we'll have the correct answer posted online in about a week. And let's take some more calls. Should we do that, Patricia?
You bet.
1-800-462-7413, the number. And here's another caller. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hi, my name's Emily. I'm from Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and I have a question about adopting kittens from a shelter.
Yeah.
I just graduated from college, and I'm looking to adopt a kitten to live with me in my apartment downtown. So I went to all the shelters to talk to people there, and there are two issues that seem to come up most. One of them is that saying that two kittens are better than one, and then the other is that declawing them is absolutely terrible thing to do. So on the two kittens issue, I'm just not sure if it's because they're like cat fanatics or if it's the experts also agree, but I work 40 hours a week and I don't want my kitten to get bored and not get exercise. But I live in a somewhat smaller apartment and I don't know if it's enough space for two cats.
Emily, these are really good questions. And on the first one about taking two versus one, I got to jump in and say there are downsides.
Yes.
You know, there are pluses and minuses, like a lot of things. The obvious upside is that if you get two kittens, then you've got two animals who can entertain each other. They can interact. They won't be alone when you're gone. However, here comes the but, right? There are a couple of downsides to that. One, besides the space issue that you mentioned, one is that two kittens are not twice the work of one kitten. It's an exponential paradigm. They are four times as much work. It's like with kids. You'll get one kid who talks the other into getting into trouble when the other one wouldn't have thought of it in the first place. So you can get two kittens who cause more trouble and are a little harder to deal with than just one kitten. Sort of egg each other on sometimes. You can also have aggression-related issues if you get two kittens from the same litter. If you look at the natural history of cats and the wild type cats that they evolve from, there's a lot of genetically mediated predispositions to disperse when they become adolescents, particularly if you get animals of the same sex. So I have had no small number of clients who've gotten two kittens from the same litter and ended up having them be great friends, but then they fight. Now, I've also had the opposite. I know lots of people who've had two kittens who were best friends. They slept together. They groomed each other. But so, in summary, I would say, no, if you don't want two kittens, I think you're okay getting one kitten. Larry he's just dying to say something.
Well, I was going to say, I'm not sure if it's the case with this particular animal shelter, but if one has many kittens in an animal shelter, and somebody comes in who looks like she or he is going to be a really good caretaker, I might push the two-kitten concept.
There's an understandable motivation for, I mean, shelters all have so many cats now. I feel so sorry for them. They're really struggling because they have such an overabundance of cats. But so in terms of the number of kittens, it's perfectly reasonable for you to consider getting one kitten. There are plenty of cats who can be very happy when you're there, even if you're gone a lot during the day. Presumably, you're home a lot in the evenings and in the morning. So that's that issue. In terms of declawing, this is a complicated one. The standard declawing is actually an amputation. The standard traditional declawing method is actually lops off the last joint of the finger-like appendages of a cat. It's a very big surgery, and there's no question about it. It's very painful. So on the declawing side, I strongly advise people to avoid declawing if they possibly can. There are lots of ways to deal with the fact that cats have claws and that they like to sharpen them and actually territorial remark by sort of scratching and things. So that's an issue I would suggest you think very long and hard before you consider declawing a cat.
Okay.
Good luck. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate
your
call. And if you'd like to join in, the number to call 1-800-462-7413. And let's take another call. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Yes, this is Dan Tucker from Sun Valley, Idaho.
Dan, thank you very much for calling. What can we do for you?
Well, I've got a black Labrador, 5 years old, and we're having serious problems getting her to go out in the morning. We live up in the mountains. We have a lot of wildlife in the area, and she tends to smell them and not want to go out.
Oh, she's scared.
Yeah.
Well, you know, there's dangerous stuff out there.
Oh, yeah, there's foxes and raccoons and elk and deer and occasional wolf. And
sure.
You got it all.
So have you tried? Here's what I would try. I'm sure you'd rather just open the door. But for a while, I would try going out with her. I'd go out with a little treat.
And we do that. Sometimes she would just go to the other room and won't come near you.
No kidding.
Yeah.
Oh, and now, how does she behave during the rest of the day? Will she go out in the afternoon, in the evening?
Generally, once it gets a little lighter and warmer.
She's scared of the dark.
Yeah.
Maybe she doesn't like the cold. Does she have any accidents?
Rarely, but sometimes she'll just do it in the house because she doesn't want to go out.
Yeah. Oh, poor thing. That's to both of you. That's to her and to you, too. I'll tell you what I do if she was my dog. Try this and then get back to us and let us know how it goes. I would get her in the habit of putting her leash on in the morning. And for a couple of days, I want you to just put her leash on. Don't try and get her up. Don't use the leash. Just put it on. So she's like, here he comes. He's going to put my leash on. Ooh, boy. I get a treat when he puts my leash on. I don't know what he's doing. Silly guy. Puts my leash on, then he gives me a treat, then he takes it off. Okay, whatever. So do that for a couple of days, and then on the third day, I want you to put her leash on, and I want you to take her outside. Have a cue that you use during the rest of the day, at night, middle of the day, when she's more likely to go outside and she's not fearful. When you go outside with her, right before she's about to go, say something, you know, say hurry up or go pee or something that's a cue that means go to the bathroom now. So when you take her out in the morning, I want you to stay outside with her, have some really great treats, not like wheat biscuits, pieces of chicken, really great stuff. What she might do is she smells the chicken in your pocket, she's going to be like jumping up and down. It's like, I want the chicken. And you're like, no, go sniff the ground. So just look away from her, ignore. Eventually she'll put her nose down on the ground. And when she finally goes out, then I want you to give her the treat right there. Good girl, treat. Here's a piece of chicken, believe it or not. And then go back inside with her. If she doesn't go, go back inside with her, but keep her with you. You can even leave the leash on if she can drag it around safely. Don't let her get hung up on something that wouldn't be safe. Take her out again in 10 minutes. Basically, you're going to treat her like a little tiny puppy. What I want her to learn is if you go outside and go potty right away, nothing's going to hurt you. You get a piece of chicken, and then you get to go right back inside.
Here's the conundrum, though. What do you do in the meantime while you're doing the training if you're not going to take the dog outside? Then
whatever he's been doing up to this point.
Okay.
Right.
All right.
Yeah, no,
if it's bad enough, she'll go.
It's a good question. Yeah, he said, you know, if it's bad enough, she'll go. So.
Okay. Thanks, Dan.
All right.
Well, hopefully things will turn out. If they don't.
We'd like to hear either way. Let us know. We'd love to hear.
And if you'd like to join in, the number to call 1-800-462-7413. That's 1-800-462-7413. Well, April is National Poetry Month, and while springtime brings new life, today's story from Baxter Black gives new meaning to the term born again.
It was one of those 2 o'clock in the morning calls. Looked like everything was coming just fine, Doc, but then he got stuck. Could you come? On the way out to the ranch, I put the truck on autopilot while my foggy brain sifted through the possibilities. Hip lock, more than likely, I figured. Well, I walked into the cabin barn, shook the snow off my coat, and surveyed the scene. Fairly peaceful. 2 unshaven cowboys playing cards in front of the space heater, and a good-sized heifer standing in the chute, looking no worse for the wear. Good, I thought. The boys have worn the heifer out before they called, or themselves, for that matter. I peeled down my short-sleeved coveralls and went to survey the battlefield. There, underneath the heifer's cocked tail, peering out at the new world, was Bentley, the baby bull calf. All I could see was his head. With his mama's help, he'd gotten far enough to pop his nose and his ears out, but no further. He didn't seem in distress, just a little embarrassed. He looked like some trophy hunter's prize hanging on the den wall. Well, since the umbilical cord hadn't broken yet, he had no need to breathe, but he was looking around like a kid in a neck brace at the county fair. After my examination, I concluded he had one front leg into the birth canal and the other one pointing straight back. He was wedged in tight as a new hat band. "Bentley," I said, "I hope you brought your scuba gear, because you got to go back inside." I gave the heifer an epidural injection so she couldn't strain. I put my hand over his nose and started to push. Bentley raised an eyebrow and looked up at me. "You sure you got a license to do this?" "Sure," says I. "I bought it from a guy in Iowa when he sold out his practice." Well, it wasn't easy, but I popped the little duffer back in, straightened his legs, and then pulled him into the outside world. He was typically ungrateful as I rubbed him down and pointed him to the breakfast nook under Mama's flank. He turned once and looked up at me and said, "I've heard of being born again, but this is ridiculous."
That was cowboy poet Baxter Black with his story titled Bentley the Born Again Bull. You can find out more about Baxter Black and his poetry and writing by visiting our website at callingallpets.org. Calling All Pets is produced by Wisconsin Public Radio. Patricia McConnell is a PhD certified applied animal behaviorist and adjunct associate professor of zoology at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. Our producer is Cynthia Schuster. Our executive producer is Charles Monroe Kane. Brad Kohlberg is our technical director. Leo Sidran composed our theme music. I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell, hoping you'll join us again next time for more Calling All Pets.
Copies of today's show are available through the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for program number 0419P. More pet tips and advice for training new dogs or leaving pets home alone are available online at callingallpets.org. Our website also features a complete list of past guests and online archives of the program. The website, once again, is callingallpets.org.